Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project. This is a podcast on One Heat Minute Productions where we look 10 years in our rearview for the films that are still hanging around or the films that are ripe rediscovery. And today I'm joined by a man who is really like the backyard marathon man of podcasters. He is created an amazing community that is truly the podcasting endurance test in our little niche of films, because whenever I do his show, I'm never more stressed or exhausted or just like completely frazzled by the end of it, that I'm just like, I'm just shaking. And then like weeks later, I'll get a couple of tweets or responses or just get flagrantly abused in the follow-up podcast. Whatever happens, it's an unbelievable thing. And amongst all this stress that he orchestrates, he's also a delightful human being. He has the best long hair in the game, and he's growing it back. I'm hoping that he will grow it back. It's my great friend, Clay Keller. Clay,
howdy.
The true commish, the commish. How are
you? What's up? Yeah, get out of here, Michael Chiklis. Fuck off. I've never seen the commish.
Seen is like the end of a TV show in Australia used to have this great commentator who would actually be the voiceover of Our Sale of the Century, you know, like those old game shows, and he'd go, okay, next up on Channel 9, the commish. Like that's enough in my pop culture brain of that show. I don't need to know anything else.
I should check that out someday. How's it going, buddy?
Yeah, good, man. It's great to see you, and thank you, because this is a movie that was definitely going to be on my list that I wanted to talk about this year in The Decade Project. We are in 2025. We're looking back to 2015. Despite the giant army hammer in the room, it is going to be an essential discussion for you and I to be talking about Guy Ritchie's The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Folks, take a listen to the trailer, and then we'll come back and talk all about it.
Are they still following us?
Yes.
Is there one of them?
Hmm?
Is he looking at us?
Hmm?
Does he have just one hand on the steering wheel?
Mm-hmm.
When you hear something that sounds like a gunshot, drive.
We recently discovered the existence of an international criminal organization with ties to former Nazis. Rumor has it
they built an atom bomb.
We have no choice but to work together to infiltrate this organization.
We'll leave you two to get acquainted.
Napoleon Solo,
the CIA's most effective agent.
Ilya Kuryaki.
KGB, the youngest man to join in our best within 3 years.
America is teaming up with Russia.
Things could get a little messy.
The thing is, I work better alone.
I work better alone too.
Okay, I'll let you tag along.
How did you get the invitation to my party?
I stole it.
So you're a thief. I hope you wear a mask.
Sometimes. Just never when I'm stealing things. Not very good at this whole subtlety thing, are you?
It'll be like this for 20 minutes. Can't touch.
Don't make me put you over my knee.
So you want to wrestle?
I did not say that.
Shall we?
Hold on, cowboy!
Special agent, you're not having a very special day, are you?
You
These belong to you or to me?
Okay, Clay. This was one of two choices. We've got another great one. I'm not going to spoil what it is. We've got another great convo that's going to be coming up, which I think is your favorite film of 2015.
We're not going to spoil it. Well, yeah. No. I started keeping fairly detailed and elaborate favorites lists. Not when I was a kid. A lot of cinephiles are like, I've got handwritten notebooks from when I was 8, like my favorite movies of the year.
I wasn't that kid either.
I started in, I think, my first year of college. At the end of the year, I started doing, anyway, I would do like for my top 10 favorites, I would do little like write-ups and not that we're shared with anybody, just for my own gratification. And
are these going to be available on Letterboxd someday? Surely there's got to be like a screen drop wiki or something.
The first 10 or so. Well, remember before Facebook was completely unusable in every way. So when I was in college, they would be on Facebook so people could look at them. And then I started a blog that I only used to put these up at the end of the year. And I didn't ever share them anywhere. So sometimes people found them because they were on Tumblr. And people would find them through, like, I think the year of Personal Shopper, that was my favorite movie. That was 2016, I think.
Yeah,
2016, 2017. And I wrote a write-up of that and says, because it had the name Kristen Stewart in the copy, people found it on Tumblr and that got shared like hundreds of times. So I was like, oh, this is wild. But yeah, there's a good chunk of these that are on. The blog is called Accounting for Taste. .tumblr.com. And there's a few years of these like elaborate lists, and it's not just it's favorites, least favorites, biggest surprises, other things. So it's just to keep my like writing fresh, unrusty. In any case, yes, if I'm remembering correctly, the one we're talking around, we're teasing for later in the year, was my favorite of 2015. Yeah. But the one we're talking about today was certainly amongst my favorites, and probably the one I've rewatched the most.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is the easiest rewatch in the world, and on Australian Netflix, I call them the dreaded carousels, where usually there's just carousels of garbage tiles of movies. And so many times it had a big run, I think, because of the Gentleman movie and then series and a few other Guy Ritchies that were just popping up on Netflix all the time, where just because of my algorithm, it would go, would you like to watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E. again? And yes, thank you. I would very much like to watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E. So,
thank you, Ted. I would very much like to watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E. again.
So, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., back when I saw this, I definitely saw it in the theater. It had a pretty good response. It had like, it wasn't a overwhelming response, but it landed in the net positive. A few people were kind of a little bit soft on it, but I think there was people around our community. I remember like the Roxana Haddadis, and there were other people that just kind of instantly got like, I love this silliness. I love its levity. I love its panache. I like the style. I love all of the attractive people that are in it. And it just really, right from the jump, I was like, this is a super fun movie. We don't get as many espionage movies that feel like this much fun. It was like a weird tonal balance between like, it's not Starsky and Hutch and it's not Mission Impossible. And it kind of fits more in like a Roger Moore 80s Bond era. Mm-hmm. Like it fits, it's kind of in that triangulation of those kind of like things. It's got some really funny moments, but I think what Guy Ritchie really adds to this, apart from his character style, is like just the style of all of the great outfits and how everyone looks, the whole look and feel of the movie. So right from the jump, I was a big fan. But when did you see it for the first time?
I saw it in theaters. I saw it. I thought the trailer was great.
Yeah.
The trailer that your listeners just enjoyed audibly. I thought the trailer was great. I was stoked. And I try to be, I aspire to be like a Roxana Haddadi or a people who you have a lot on your podcasts, people that you gravitate towards, Bilga, people who are able to kind of ignore the extra textual. Because I remember this movie comes out and it's still in the like, oh, Guy Ritchie, you know, the whole world was kind of eye rolling at Guy Ritchie. Everybody was like, who is this movie for? The Man from U.N.C.L.E. is a show from 50 years ago that nobody cares about. Like, there was a lot of sort of like people kind of going like, okay, when The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was coming out. And I just thought it looked like fun as hell. And I feel like like people who got it right away. And were like, Vikander was everywhere. People were sick of Vikander. It was just, there was a lot of stuff swirling around this movie, and it didn't, oh, at least in the States, it did not open well.
No, didn't.
It got, I remember, I think he said, I mean, I hate to, you know, use Rotten Tomatoes as the barometer for everything, but I feel like it ended up somewhere in like the mid to high 60s on Rotten Tomatoes.
High 60s, which is okay. Has good,
which is fine.
Yeah.
But it was truly a kind of, am I on crazy pills moment, seeing this movie opening weekend and being like, this fucking rocks.
Yeah.
And then having to like almost drag people to go be like, you really had to put in the like legwork to convince people to see this, as though the very fun trailer and people like, you know, people you trust being like, this is a super fun movie. It really, this is one that has been very gratifying to see over the years. You know, there's the OGs like you and me, and I feel like people about 5 years ago, people started really like going like, oh yeah, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was really good. But unlike Australia, the big problem for Man from U.N.C.L.E. and its kind of ongoing reputation, and it's, I mean, there's several reasons why there hasn't been a sequel now, but before, the big reason there isn't going to be a sequel. The other reason there was not a sequel, one, it was expensive to make and didn't make a ton of money at the box office, but then it was just never on a subscription streamer in the States ever. Yeah. It was not on Netflix. It never went on Max. Hulu. It just, for whatever reason, it just never showed up anywhere. And those of us who were really banging the drum for Man from U.N.C.L.E. were so frustrated because we just knew that, like, put this on Netflix, and it would have been 2017 or something. It would have been before Netflix was completely, just like you were saying, just this, you know, wasteland that is unnavigable. It would have popped. It would have really popped if it had landed on a subscription streamer within like two years ish of coming out. I think we would have a sequel.
Yeah.
Now, if that had happened.
Besides the big elephant in the room, I think Guy Ritchie, because in Oz, it was almost like undeniable that he would have to be here, because the, you know, since Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, Guy Ritchie's movies seem to play in Oz. And I think like there's a huge contingent of even just like regular movie going punters that like when people, you know, when his Gentleman series came out on Netflix, you know, people know what I do in my normal day job, like outside sort of broadly. And they're like, have you watched The Gentleman? Have you seen The Gentleman? Like so many people, just every time there's a Guy Ritchie something, people are like, have you seen this? Oh, it's really good. And so like that kind of British gangster, Snatchers, you know, Lock, Stocks, that he's always had a lot of favor there. And I know that a lot of people don't like The Gentleman, the film or the series. I really like both. So I'm kind of like one of those people.
I have not checked it. I liked the movie. Okay. But the series looked interesting. I've heard nothing about it. Nobody has said anything about it.
The series of The Gentleman, to take the quickest digression, is just set in one of the families that Mickey's business would work with, as in the marijuana underground growth operation. It's set with one of those families whose patriarch dies, and then his son comes home and takes the mantle. And like kind of the first few episodes are Gentleman movie light ish and then by about the fourth episode actually finds its voice and starts telling their stories, and it really works. Great actors. Theo James is super charming in it. Really good show. Had a good time watching it. But his stuff always seems to play. Like Guy Ritchie as a name brand, very recognizable, and because of the whole Oz UK connection, it's like British filmmakers and British films will just get played here. So this has been playing for years, and it's just like every time, or when it did, it just lived. It's the first time I've gone to rewatch it. I mean, I don't rewatch it on Netflix anymore because I've got a beautiful 4K, but it's like the first time I actually just checked, is it still on Netflix? Oh no, it's on Prime, and it's still like at the top of the lists. People still watch it all the time.
That's so great. That warms my heart.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear that Ritchie is received very differently, in Australia, because yeah, here in the States, Guy Ritchie, there are the people, like I said, like the Roxanne Haddadis, or in, you know, Brandon Sriznigs, who are like low key, like Guy Ritchie's like throwing heaters. The general populace is real, like Michael Keaton jerking off, rolling his eyes emoji about Guy Ritchie. Like ever since he dated Madonna, or was married to Madonna for like the last 20 years.
Yeah.
His name has just elicited derision.
Yeah. He went through a weird period there. I think we can all agree, the poor guy. But when you look at his resume, and I would just say this is like, you do this so well on your beautiful show. It's just like, so across the board, some filmmakers have, you know, 17, 20 films, whatever the case may be, 30 films sometimes. I'm always of the opinion, if you gave us like 4 or 5 absolutely great films, lifetime pass. And totally. When I look at his stuff, I'm like, yes, there are some, you know, if you go, you know, you look at the Madonna one with Swept Away, of course you're going to think that. But like, he made us Lock, Stock, then Snatch, and then The Gentleman I really, really, really like, made The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and he made Wrath of Man, which rules, and The Covenant, also really good. Operation Fortune, Rudiger is like Jason Statham doing Mission Impossible. I will not hear a bad thing about that movie. It's so stupid.
I love The Man from U.N.C.L.E. so much. I saw, what was that thing called again?
Operation
Fortune.
Yeah.
I saw that opening weekend in the theaters.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And it was me and my girlfriend and...
Yeah,
that was it.
And then he made his own, like, you know, his Inglourious Bastards, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, where Alan Richardson is just wearing tiny glasses and being a gigantic man. If you think my wife hasn't watched that movie 3 times, she hasn't watched, like, she probably hasn't watched like The Godfather 3 times, but she watched
I don't know about this Alan Richardson. Every time Alan Richardson pops up in something, immediately afterwards my girlfriend says, should we watch Reacher? I'm like, I don't like this. This man's too big. He's too large.
Too big. He's too beautiful. I don't even get how his muscles get that big. He's unbelievable. No, we're a Reacher house. We're a Reacher family. I think Guy Ritchie, from all of those movies, really gets like, he gets like male beauty. And he's just like, I'm going to put it up on screen. I'm going to make this thing look cool. And I genuinely think Wrath of Man is a masterpiece. Wrath of Man is such an underrated heist movie. And for all anyone who's listening, there's a terrific armored car van Ozploitation film directed by Australia's Bruce Beresford called Money Movers, mm-hmm. Which was, I think, on our like extended list when we said our like honorable mentions on our Ozploitation draft.
It came up during the Ozploitation draft. Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't make the list.
Didn't make Maybe the cut. Not, no. It's not, but I think that he really nails it in Wrath of Man. Like that he mm-hmm. just knocks it out of the park. So yeah. But I'm just a fan. I would never watch The Aladdin, though. I'm sorry. That's
horrible. I did see The Aladdin.
I love that movie. I love the original Aladdin too much that I just pretend it doesn't exist. I can't.
Yeah, no, and that's his biggest hit, probably, but easily his biggest hit.
Yeah.
No, that's a horrible film. No, but Guy Ritchie understands aesthetics, and I feel like he has an appreciation for cool, but in a way that it doesn't bother me. There are some filmmakers that are very like self-consciously cool, and it just feels like an affect, and it feels like they're trying to imitate something or chase something, and it feels insincere in a way. I think Guy Ritchie, he got a lot of anybody who has a really specific style, it's a double-edged sword. Having a really specific, identifiable, you know, what we may call an auteur kind of style, is some people connect with it so deeply that your films become these like elevated objects. They stop being films and they're just like, people are obsessed with them.
Yes.
And then people who are not jibing with that, it's just way too powerful a flavor. But people, audiences are largely not simple-minded, but simple. They're, they are, you know, they are able to criticize. They're able to criticize something that they can identify. A lot of things in art and film are ineffable. But if you have a really strong style and someone can watch something and be like, I recognize this, this, and this, these movies are all the same vision, then you can be like, I don't like what he does. It's always like, does the same thing, always does. It's the people who rag on Wes Anderson. It's the people who rag on, you know, Workman directors who don't have an identifiable style. Nobody's ever like, oh, I hate another
cannot stand Carl Franklin. And you're like,
oh, yeah, but that is the double-edged sword of being the rare filmmaker who can really have an authorial stamp on something that the layman can identify. Is you're either going to have fanboys or sort of detractors, and you get in the crosshairs because you're the only, you know, people that they can spot.
Yes.
And then the fanboys become so annoying that then they turn off casual filmmaker film viewers, and then you're Guy Ritchie and the people who are like, you know, started dressing like the characters in Snatch or whatever, and you're like, oh shit. or the Snyder fanboys or the whatever. I love Man from Uncle.
I love Man from
Uncle. How much are we supposed to talk about the entirety of Guy Ritchie's
I think career? when we're setting the scene of, like, you know, we kind of on the Decade Project, we find ourselves sort of like setting the scene. What was the, you know, it made a modest amount of money, what our initial impressions were. And then we've kind of gotten around to, like, what's the leg, we're running up to that legacy of, like, who is Guy Ritchie now today? And I think that what's super interesting, and this is just one big wrinkle, is Guy Ritchie now has moved into producing television shows. So there was a couple of, like, more failed ones that happened. There was a Lock, Stock TV series, which was very small. There was a Snatch TV series, didn't really work. And then it feels like to me that the Gentleman TV series on Netflix, maybe just a combination of money and infrastructure and then obviously, like, reach, really actually was like a modest hit on Netflix, got really good reviews for the most part. Mm-hmm. It's actually like the highest reviewed thing. If you look at, like, IMDb and things like that, audiences reviewing that. And then now he's got, like, this mob, he's producing this Mobland series that's on Paramount Plus with Tom Hardy and Pierce Brosnan. He's got some things happening. He feels like he's in the culture. But the biggest thing that happened recently, and I agree some people might be completely mad about this, I'm one of them, is that Amazon bought Bond.
Like, that's true.
And they bought Bond, and I don't know why the richest people in the world feel like they need to make polls on social media services, but this is the world that we live in. Like, Jeff Bezos asked the fans, now, who do you want to be Bond? Right? And overwhelmingly, that audience, for better or worse, all just screamed Henry Cavill.
Right. He's got an interesting fan base, Henry Cavill does.
He is the thirstiest. I don't know if it's because he builds computers, paints Warhammer, like, is in that show that I don't even know what that show is called, like, that was on Netflix, that was a gigantic show.
The Witcher,
there you go. Yeah,
I mean, there is nothing that the nerd hordes are more excited to have than, like, an Ubermensch nerd who can lead them. We're like, oh my god, this built handsome guy is a nerd. Well, we're going to follow him to the ends of the earth. He really, like, this is why Vin Diesel's always trying to convince people that he's like a D&D player or whatever. I feel like if you can be a big action Hollywood guy and also convince people that you are really just a nerd like them, then you can control the world.
Exactly. So, like, when you look at his stuff, and this is just an algorithm on IMDb. What is this guy known for? Well, Henry Cavill, of course, he's known for the Superman performances, Man of Steel, Justice League, Superman, Batman v Superman. The fourth one on that list is The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Hell yeah.
And I think in the last 10 years, especially that conversation around who's going to be Bond, when there was all this talk of even when Bond was still owned by Broccoli and Wilson, and, like, who could be the next Bond, when I kept having Man from U.N.C.L.E. pop up in my, like, repeat cycle of just, like, this is a comfort movie, I'm totally happy to just switch off and watch it again, I just look at him, I'm like, look at this guy. he looks like a Bond. The suits, the eyes, the hair. I'm like, this guy's a Bond. Like, absolutely. It just feels like it was this continual sliding door of you hear about actors who auditioned for Bond or Batman or whatever and just didn't get the part. And here, it's like such a Bond character that I just kept going like, well, now literally Amazon have polled the audience. And I don't know how much they're going to impose that on Amy Pascal or David Heyman as the new producers and architects of the Bond franchise. But it's like,
right.
There's this guy in the last 10 years. What has happened? It's like Henry Cavill being Bond has been the overwhelming thing that people want to happen. And, you know, we might find out sooner or later in between the time we're recording and the time that this actually gets posted. We could talk about it on our next catch up. But like this feels to me like one of the massive things. Guy Ritchie has low-key in this mid-budget range has been making really successful movies that don't cost a squillion dollars to make. And they keep giving him money to make more stuff and he keeps making it. And Henry Cavill has had a very weird and wonderful career with all these thirsty, crazy nerds across a whole bunch of different genres. And now the Bond franchise is after him as well.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offering, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
The new year is the perfect moment to set your family up for success, including finding a school that finally fits the way your child learns. Introducing K-12 Powered Schools, tuition-free, accredited online public schools for grades K through 12. With K-12, students move at their own pace, with state-certified teachers who bring lessons to life through interactive, hands-on technology. If your child needs a school that adapts to them, K-12 can help unlock their full potential. Learn more at k12.com/podcast.
Well, it's so interesting. Yeah, Bond has followed such a, you know, predictable pattern of not usually casting the most obvious person, which has always been fun. It's been, you know, Bond has been historically not a brass ring. It has been sort of a launching pad.
Yes.
So it would be disappointing if they just were like, all right, who's the most obvious one? Yeah, it's him. Make it him.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. I like Henry Cavill's performances. If they make him Bond, he'll do a good job. But what I like about this Napoleon Solo character is that he is so Bond as to come around to be un-Bond again. He is like, you know, cartoon Bond. And that's what I like about Napoleon Solo is and about Armie Hammer's character, whose name I can never remember.
Ilya Kuryakin.
Kuryakin. They are both playing this just almost as human cartoon characters.
Yes.
Just right up on the line of being human cartoon characters, particularly Cavill, in a way that is really fun. And it facilitates my favorite part of this movie is, which is I love the period style. I think the action is pretty good. There's not a ton of romance, but I think that the chemistry between Vikander and Hammer is pretty good. What made this movie really pop for me is the comedy.
Yes.
I think big screen comedy has been going downhill for a long time, and especially comedy that is not banter based. making everything improv banter was like really fun in 2004 and 2005 and has completely sucked and ruined comedy for the last ever since then.
I think it genuinely my peak is like it peaked at Superbad and then we could just close the door.
Sure. 2007.
Yeah. 2007, Superbad? Eight. Yeah. Superbad peak. And it's like, okay, we're done.
Downhill
here,
from there. People stopped knowing how to write comedy. People stopped knowing how to direct comedy. This movie is very funny. And we're going to maybe go through it in a little bit more minute detail. But there are sequences of visual comedy.
Yeah.
That have to be thought out, planned in a very intentional, meticulous way that are so funny and are things that I literally do not see anyone else doing. It's the type of film making visual comedy that was basically commonplace in like the 80s, but just designing a frame where there are things happening in the foreground, things happening in the background, playing off of the dramatic irony there where the audience can see both things and the characters cannot see what the others are. Just that stuff like that, designing the frame to convey silent comedy that is just based in what you're seeing. That is so fucking great. And there's several sequences like that in this movie. And the actors are all so game and so perfectly calibrated. Debicki in this movie is just fucking terrific.
She can't do anything bad as far as I'm concerned. She's just always great.
But I can get into specifics if you care.
Yeah,
to.
Yeah, please.
That's really the thing. I mean, obviously the moment in the trailer that really sold me on this movie. And again, the soundtrack is phenomenal here as well. So fun. The Pemberton score is,
yeah.
From this moment on, I was eyes on Pemberton. It's not that often
stock on Pemberton. Where's the stock?
Yeah.
Pemberton?
I'm like, what is he doing next? And I don't know if he's reached his full potential. In my opinion, the Spider-Verse scores are tremendous. I mean, I think he's doing really good work. His work on Slow Horses is a lot of fun. But his score here is so good. The soundtrack is so good. But the moment, and it's in the trailer, when Kurikan is playing chess in the foreground, and Vikander has those big dumb glasses on, sunglasses, and she goes out of frame, playing with people leaving frame, coming back into frame. Again, just like filmmaking 101 shit that no one ever does anymore. But going off frame, turning the music on, and then like sliding back in and starting to do her dance is such great physical comedy. Doing that all in the one take and designing the layers of the shot like that and the timing is all so great. And it's just fun. It's funny and it's fun. And it endears you to those characters because you're having fun with them. I mean, another great one is where the Nazi torture guy gets stuck in the chair and they're having the sort of banal conversation in the foreground while he starts on fire in the background.
Yes.
Another great moment, but really sort of like the piece de resistance sequence in this movie is when they go to break into the satellite factory and they end up in the boat, the driving around the closed off harbor boat chase thing, while Solo gets in the truck and like puts on like the napkin and starts eating the meal, and the background things are exploding and he's eating the meal. That is such a great sequence and so funny. And this great blend of action and then the complete playing off the complete opposite end of this very like high class kind of quiet moment where he's, you know, drinking a glass of wine and having the sandwich, and the comedy fully comes from the character.
Yeah.
Like you're informed so about so much of this character in this moment, you know,
and their interplay. So what's so good is that Solo is taking the piss out of Ilya in that moment and we're cackling, and Ilya's in this really intense moment. He's having a sandwich, glass of wine. He's just, oh, this is good. And then he puts his seatbelt on and just drives off and just like
drives off. Great climax. It builds and builds and builds. And it's in the rhythm of the way it's shot, the rhythm of the edit. But what I love about it is Richie, who, you know, either fairly or unfairly got this reputation for being this chaotic filmmaker who is just constantly moving the camera and double exposing and cutting all the time and all of his, you know, sort of stylistic gimmicks. This one, very tamped down in terms of his usual bag of tricks. But this movie is almost the total opposite.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's not like everything is played out in a one-er, which again, oh, you did something in a one-er. Round of applause. But it is just the visual imagination, and it is that in that, you know, inherent sense of cinema that the greats have of seeing it in their head and playing it out and like I said, building a frame and putting the effort into that. And this scene, that scene would not be nearly as funny if it was cut back, cut back, cut back, cut back. He gets in the car, you know, cut to Ilya, cut to close up, cut, 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 cut. Seeing it play out and have that sort of
it
rhythm.
It builds up to a staccato where you think it's going to do that. And then it just stops dead.
Yeah.
And him taking the time to like tuck a napkin into his neck. It's like, and then what's so cool is we've seen how big the scale of explosions are. And now all we're seeing is that the light in the cab, of the truck is just changing because there's a massive explosion. We have no idea what's going on. It's fantastic because it's like, we've already seen some of the chaos and there's more explosions and we hear gunfire and we hear this and we hear yelling. And he's just like, oh, this is just a perfect time to have a sandwich and a little cheeky glass of wine. It's just those little touches. It's the time that the man from Uncle gets like the closest to the Naked Gun. Any movie, I mean, I know that there is now a Naked Gun movie. I also think it's a crime that was that Liam Neeson didn't dye his hair gray to be in the Naked Gun. I just think it's a crime. I'm telling everyone now that it's a crime. But just that whole ethos of like, we're setting up something so ridiculous. We're orchestrating all this chaos. And then how funny is it that we're not even going to show you what we've just orchestrated? We're just going to show you a guy sitting in a cab doing that. And then bang, it happens. It's great.
I'm glad you brought up Naked Gun and Zucker Abrahams because, that is the genius of those guys specifically, but also that kind of thing is just knowing how to use the frame.
Yes.
To make a joke and to tell a story, and jokes are little stories, you know, that's what they are.
Yeah.
They're little two line stories or one moment stories, and just knowing, how to manipulate what the audience is looking at or what the right comedic timing to show them something that makes something sing. And Richie really nails that here. And the dialogue is funny too. The dialogue is, I laugh so hard every time I see the scene when they're picking out the outfits for Vikander and they start, the two men start arguing over women's fashion. And he's like, it's a good, get the belt. It's like, it's not going to match. And Armie Hammer's delivery of it does not need to match. It's just, that's so funny. I love that line. I love that delivery. Hammer is so, you know, his accent's a little bit but that doesn't matter at all.
His accent needs to be wonky.
It needs to be. He's a cartoon.
He's a cartoon. That's the thing. It's like, in this, I don't care if he's not speaking pristine Russian. He's playing a cartoon. Like, he's meant to be. He's got a look. He's kind of like, he's got a look that he needs to hit. And the funniest thing is I want him to kind of be fumbling over the accent when he's arguing about whether a belt needs to match or whether it's more striking if it doesn't. It's funny. It's just hilarious. Yeah. And there's a really funny behind the scenes story where Henry Cavill's like, you know, we'd be on set, you know, Army, myself, Alicia, Elizabeth Debicki, eventually, you know, Jared Harris, Hugh Grant. We'd be on set and some of us would be in all these like beautiful couture. And then we'd look behind the camera, like you standing like, beside the camera as he's orchestrating the movie is Guy Ritchie in a gorgeous three-piece suit with cuffs. They're like, he always looked so much better than us. And this movie, it's like, he's behind the frame and he looks like a million bucks. He's like very, very stylish, always looking very kind of like Ray Winston, you know, like couture sort of levels, like, you know, great, looked fantastic. He's got a cigar at the end of the day. This is the guy that was directing the movie. I'm like, that's the kind of image. I want the behind the scenes photo of Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin and Gabby there in all their like great couture. And then you pan to the right. It's like a Tom Ford movie. There's a guy in a gorgeous three-piece suit with cuffs and just looking a million bucks, like behind the frame as well.
Gotta set the tone.
Gotta set the tone. That's it. I don't want to go. You're a schlubby guy wearing a hat. You're not Spielberg. Let's get some Guy Ritchie, Tom Ford. I'm wearing a three-piece suit. Kind of behind the camera action happening.
I think you bring it back. What Paul Feig's the other guy who does that, the three-piece suit on set.
Yeah,
I love that, and I love I watched a little bit of behind the scenes stuff on this on my Blu-ray. I have not picked up the 4K yet, shamefully. The Blu-ray looks great. I mean, the cinematography in this looks fantastic too. Honestly, it's one of those I was remarking on this to my girlfriend, but I feel like you and I and people like us just, you know, have this now very tired refrain of like every movie, the shittiest movie from the 90s looks better than the movie that, you know, won
cost
the,
$300 the
Oscar
million
for cinematography this year or whatever. And the 90s is now 30 years ago. I had that feeling watching this movie from 10 years ago. I was like, this movie has better photography than probably almost any of the like lauded films cinematography from the last a year. I'm like, it is distressing to me that the tail on this thing is getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yes.
It's like, I get like 30 years, fine. 10 years? This is how much we've degraded in 10 years? This is terrifying.
You brought up a great topic, which is there is just so much more content. There are more films being made than ever before, even though a lot of them now go to streaming services. There is so much TV, like the heroes that work in television criticism across the board. Some of them are friends, Roxana, I think, like those guys who work in television criticism and try and navigate keeping up with what shows they think are going to be important in the year and giving every show their due. I literally have no clue how they consume that much media and have it in their brain. No. And I just honestly think it's like brain rot when you see some of the quality of these things. And then when it comes around, you know, coming up in Australia, there's this beautiful clip that's doing the rounds right now. And people on our Patreon who will listen to this now and future people who are listening later in the year, the legendary Ryan Coogler is doing this like PSA about formats, which I think is now up to like 50 million views as of this morning. And I'm like, that's why then when Ryan Coogler comes out and goes, I'm making Sinners and this is how we shot it, or why Chris Nolan is shooting in like IMAX and why, you know, like huge sequences of Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning rather, are shot in IMAX. And you see all these filmmakers gravitating towards these purely cinematic formats and trying to orchestrate the frames in these gorgeous ways and like elevate things. You're like, that's why when those come out, people go insane. Like, why do you think people go insane for them? Well, because they look fucking amazing. They know that cinema is a visual medium at the end of the day, and they want to make sure that people have a tactile experience. It's not just a televisual serial. It's like it needs to have a unique look. And so that's one thing at least I can say with Guy Ritchie is like, I'm always interested in what he's doing, even if I don't necessarily like the content, because I know it's going to have style, it's going to have panache, it's going to have flair, it's going to have an aesthetic that he's picked for the characters, for the story. And he does have a bag of tricks. And I think when you're young, you have a bag of tricks and you have a skill set. But then this thing happens, and it's like the thing that happened with Sidney Lumet, thing happened with John Frankenheimer, is they made so much visual media when they were learning, like made live TV and stuff.
Right.
They had a bag of tricks, but then they'd repeat themselves and they'd hate watching it back because they were repeating themselves. And so what happens is when you're younger, you repeat yourself and then you're like, oh, you see it more, or it's more prevalent. And you're like, I can't keep repeating myself. I've got to find new tools.
Right.
And so, I think some of that is coming back. And I think the advent of 4K, particularly in the physical media heads like you and I, it's like when you watch a great filmmaker's film on 4K, you see how they actually fill the frame. It's like, man, that's out there. People are looking at it. Like I watched Arthur Penn's Night Moves the other day and I was just like, look at this fucking movie. Look at how they made movies, Clay. They made movies. It's just, it's a special skill. And Man from U.N.C.L.E., it's great. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. Night Moves, great in the look at how they made movies visually, like less in the like naked teenagers, but like definitely.
That, yeah. but right back up in the
post-coital
fondue. Like,
bring it back. Movies used to have post-coital fondue. That's
a topic for Screen Junkies.
As somebody who,
a one of one not moves.
As somebody who, like, I don't consider myself generally to be a very like persnickety or like uptight person or whatever, but I don't eat in bed. That just, like, I'm like, the idea of getting, like, you know, food in my sheets or whatever is very off. So the idea of eating fondue in bed is really, I'm like, wow,
that's a braver man than me. Yeah. I think
uninhibited.
Yeah. No, I'm also not a food in bed guy. I think the last time I ate food in my bedroom was like when I had COVID like 3 or 4 years ago. It's like I wasn't leaving the room. So my wife was bringing stuff up to the door and they're like knocking and I'd wait till she went away and I'd go get the food and eat it in the bed. But yeah, it's not for me either. It's not for me. It's definitely not in the class of Man from U.N.C.L.E. There's no food eating in bed here.
I don't think so. There's not. This movie, the locations, the sets, these hotels. I mean, Guy Ritchie in the behind the scenes thing I watched has said something that I think a lot of people say, but I don't know if it's always true, is that he said, I make the movies I want to watch.
Yes.
And I feel like as an artist, you know, that I think that is the purest sort of animating principle, is just making something that is something that you would want to see. If you saw this trailer, you know, for this movie in the theater, would you say, oh God, ooh, this is going to the top of the list? Then that's the movie you should make, because that's going to be organic. I mean, even if it is a remake of an old television show set in the 60s that is sort of, you know, heightened and cartoony and all about style and cool one-liners and whatever, it's still going to feel like it comes from an honest place. And I do, and I love, it's been a while since I've seen this. It's been at least 3 or 4 years, but since the last time I saw this movie, I watched all of the Michael Caine, Harry Palmer films.
Great box set on Imprint. I've got it over here. Yeah, great.
Oh, they've got there's a box set now. They're kind of hard to track down in the States. They're all separate and
they're all separate.
Out of print and whatever. Yep. Oh, there's a box set. Ryan and I did a really fun franchise draft of those, the three original like 60s movies and then the like much later 80s television movies, 90s maybe even. But they were talking in the behind the scenes, the screenwriter and Richie were talking about how they were designing this movie as an homage, as a visual callback to the great early 60s spy movies. And they didn't enumerate titles, but I had to imagine they're talking about those first couple of Bond movies. And then I was really getting a lot of In Napoleon Solo. And maybe this is in the show too. I don't know the show at all. So I assume some of the characteristics and things come from the show.
As familiar with the commish as we are with the original,
Original Man from U.N.C.L.E. But I was getting a lot of Harry Palmer in Napoleon Solo. Like he's at least in like the cooking and the you know, the being very like proper and put together and calm. And then the visual style too. I love the Ipcress file.
Is so great. I think when I think of what this movie looks, feels like to me, it's Guy Hamilton's Funeral in Berlin. Like that's like that. If you watch Funeral in Berlin, which is in the
middle, and they're certainly both, yes,
set there. But if you watch
East-West Berlin movies,
if you watch that, they're just like, and Guy Hamilton, amazing Bond filmmaker. If you watch that, it's like the triangulation of like Bond style and all those things are working so harmoniously. Yeah. It's so great. Like with Ipcress,
and even then the third Palmer movie, the Ken Russell one, Billion Dollar Brain.
Oh yeah, that's a,
which is in and of itself sort of the halfway between Ipcress and Bond movie.
Yeah.
But I just love that style. I love that thing. Like, you know, I think it's so fun that Richie decided to do this as a period piece instead of being like, you know, Man from U.N.C.L.E. modern day. It's like, I don't know.
And
And the 60s were cooler. Just do it in the 60s.
And this is what I was going to say. This is the final word. The main lesson now, aside from we know why there's no sequels, the one great idea that I had heard was like, Nolan has always wanted to do Bond. The one thing that a lot of people around that Bond community, which I'm much a satellite for because I love the franchise so much, is like they want a throwback period Bond. And I'm like, you've got the template. It's Man from U.N.C.L.E. You take that style, that panache, you want to make it a little bit more like fun and have levity instead of the more serious Craig Bonds, which I also, by the way, adore. So there's no shade to those. They're just different. But I'm like, you've got a template for how to do this. You go to some beautiful exotic location, you get all these gorgeous outfits, you have these gorgeous actors. You might have to paint out the corners because modernity is encroaching or has encroached fully. But you go to these locations and you shoot it and you just have a blast in like a period film where everyone is smoking and everyone's using lo-fi tech. And it's like, maybe that's where some of these characters who are finding a difficulty translating to modern visions. It's like, we'll make it a throwback. And now with Amazon money, like make it a huge throwback. Make three different films.
All of those characters. And yeah, we shouldn't dedicate too much time talking about Bond, but I think that is a obvious parallel that needs to be drawn is these characters were speaking to the time they were created in.
Yes.
Not every character is eternal.
No.
And it can be, you know, used to make a cogent commentary on we're 80 years or whatever away from 60 years away from those original Bond movies.
Yes.
That character is not going to continue to make sense in a modern context.
You can't bring the Outlaw Josie
until the end of time.
You can't make the Outlaw Josie Wales a contemporary thing. It's a Western that you have to set as a period film. Like, it just is what it is. Like, you can have comparisons, you can make sort of neo-westerns, etc., but if you want to use that character, sometimes the smartest thing is like, oh, I'm making a period western, and then you can have a lot of commentary about your time through that prism, but you're using the tactile, like, we're in that throwback to make it. Man, this has been so much fun talking to you. Thank you so much for gushing about The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
It's so good,
and I'm glad that it's out. The 4K is gorgeous. Double feature if you want some Guy Ritchie, Henry Cavill, Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, straight back to back on those 4Ks. Stunning.
Fun movie. I want to, if people didn't check out Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, I do want to tell you, like, don't go in being like, I'm going to love this as much as The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Or Inglorious Bastards.
It's not quite that level, but it is.
It's fine.
Super worth watching.
It's the most reliable mid-level burger that you could receive. It's not like a high-end gourmet delicious burger. It's McDonald's. It's just does the job that you, it does what it says on the tin.
Yeah.
It's fun. Super fun.
I had it. You guys get McDonald's served in tins in Oz?
No. Sorry. I conflated some metaphors. but it
I
just
these McDonald's tins. I got to say, like, this is the second time in a week that so I've been talking to somebody about a movie and they have used the like McDonald's analogy. Be like, it's McDonald's. All I can think of is like a week and a half ago, I had a quarter pounder with cheese at McDonald's. That was so good. I've been thinking about it ever since.
It's the quarter pounder that Clay's still thinking about. That's what it is.
He started using fresh beef on those quarter pounders. And it's just, it takes it up a level. This is that's what Man from U.N.C.L.E. is. This is Guy Ritchie, like, starting to use fresh beef.